Feral Audio.
Well, hello. It's time for another Drew Drogi's Minor Revelations. Hi, I'm Drew Drogi. Wouldn't it be weird if I weren't? Welcome back. Thank you so much for hanging in there. I know it's been a long time since I've done a show. I've had so many lovely people come up to me and tell me that they listen to the show, which is so nice. And I love that. I'm sorry I've been gone. I was in New York for 3 weeks and it was the holidays and then Palm Springs. You guys, it's just been a whole thing. But we are back. I'm really excited for 2017. I actually am. I'm very excited for this year. I think it's going to be a year of creative explosion. I think it's going to be a loud, beautifully angry year. I think a lot of people are going to be, just blowing up with what's inside. And I think that's really important. And I'm hopeful. And anyway, so I'm just excited to keep doing this show. One thing I just wanted to start off, this is kind of weird, but whatever. I wanted to share something that I did in New York that I just highly recommend. If you're like me and you like finding things that are like so bad that they're good, that gets harder and harder to do. You know, growing up, I was like, oh, this is a terrible horror movie. Let's watch it. And I loved it. I laughed so hard. I mean, Sleepaway Camp, Sleepaway Camp 2, Unhappy Campers, Sleepaway Camp 3, Teenage Wasteland. Yes, I know those. Those are great. So bad, they're fun movies. There's a lot of things that are like, you know, I love Everything's Terrible online. I think they find some real, as Sam Pancake would call them, some real stink blossoms. And Dave Holmes and I every year host Bad Movie Night at Outfest, and we find a terrible LGBT film that we dig up out of God knows where. Usually Dave has this genius collection of trash that I love. So I love it. I love finding things that are like, oh my God, this is so bad. It's wonderful. But that's very hard because some things are just bad that they're bad. I mean, John Waters talks about good, bad taste and bad, bad taste. And he, above everybody, has to know this because everything gets called. It's sort of like a John Waters movie, and nothing is like a John Waters movie unless John Waters' name is on it. But there are so many things that I that people want to share with me, and I'm like, oh, it kind of is, or it's too aware that it's bad and it's trying to be bad, which is always just a horrible thing when you're like, oh, it's winking at me. Oh, it thinks it's smarter than me. I don't like this. But all my life I have wanted, as long as I have known about New York City, which has been all my life, there has been this show running in New York, in Times Square, since 1987. And if you know what I'm talking about, you already know that it's called Perfect Crime. And yes, it has been running in 1987 with the same lead actress from the beginning. She's in the, her name is Catherine Russell, of course. She's been running this show. I think she's done over 12,000 performances where she plays this psychiatrist named Margaret. Margaret Brent, I think it's her name. Margaret Brent. She's been doing this for so long. I mean, beyond. There's no way anyone for the rest of time will ever be able to top this record. 30 years. She's missed 4 performances, apparently for family weddings. And you know those family members have never heard the end of it because Catherine Russell's got a show. Never taken a sick day. What a feat. So I've always wanted to go see this show. And it's like, you know, whenever I've been in New York, I'm either, I've been, you know, working or I'm busy with friends or I'm going to see like, you know, a show that I'm like, this is important. I have to go see this new, hot, fun, great, horrible, whatever show. So I have never made the time. Well, then this year I was there for 3 weeks. I was doing my solo show. I did get to see a bunch of great stuff in between here and there. And, but I was like, oh my God, I had Christmas Day plans, but Christmas Eve, I had a show that afternoon, but I was like, I don't have anything tonight, Christmas Eve night. So my friend Pete Zayas, who's also been on the show before, was in town and he was like, what do you want to do? You want to get together for, you know, Christmas Eve? And I was like, perfect. Do you want to go see Perfect Crime? So we went, and I am so glad I went. And I'm telling you, all the negative things I'm going to say about it, I'm highly recommending it at the same time. It is a, I mean, it is a maelstrom of mistakes. So the set is like a sort of like Mousetrap, like very dusty murder mystery, you know, sitting room of a wealthy psychiatrist. Her name's Margaret Brent. It is the most convoluted plot. There's a painting that's over the fireplace that's made out of bricks. That's like, I was on the front row and I couldn't understand what the painting was, but it was like some like kind of vaguely offensive, like migrant workers, but it was all made in bricks and it's just so garish. And of course it's a big plot point. There's a plate of miniature coffee cakes that, everyone eats coffee cake in the plate, 'cause that's the thing that people do. I guess in 87, that was the thing. There's so many phone calls. We forget that in 1987, we were always on the phone and so much information is on the other end of the phone call. So you're having to wait for the actor to go, "What? The FBI is coming? What? They think..." So apparently she's accused of killing her husband, and you don't know if she did it or not. However, the play opens with a scene where there is a man who is identified as her husband talking on the phone while a woman runs down. Her entrance is she runs down the stairs in a red plastic Halloween hideaway wig and shoots him so many times, so much loud gunfire. Catherine Russell has shot that gun over 12,000 times, times 30, you know? And she's shooting this man and he does the terrible stage thing of, "Oh no, oh no, oh no." And he's twirling around. The gunshots are spinning him off stage right. 'Cause when you get shot, it's like, oh, that's how it happens. And so the whole time you're like trying to figure out, like, did this woman kill him or not? But you just watched the only woman in the play kill the man who's identified as the husband. The plot is impossible to figure out, and it's not what you think it is, but you also don't care what it is. Her performance is such a special kind of, it's, you have to see it. You guys have got to go see it, because she seems so tired and also so manic to get the play done, because she's done it so many times. She has no idea what she's saying anymore. I promise you, she spends most of the play with her eyes closed, screaming her lines. She's also in amazing shape. Obviously, this woman's in great shape. But, you know, a 60-year-old woman playing a 30-year-old. So she still has the vocal quality of a 30-year-old. She hasn't matured or figured that out at all. And the character is supposed to be, I don't know. She talks a lot about college. And she has this very sexy interlude with the investigator, because of course, you know, the whole thing is like trying to be CSI, trying to be Basic Instinct. It feels a lot more like, like a high school, like The Murder Room, if you know that very, we did that play in high school. No one is going to know what I'm talking about. But it is fascinating. Also, sold out. Packed. You got to get a ticket early for Perfect Crime, because, you know, this woman, it doesn't matter. It has the worst reviews. If you go on and read reviews, you're like, this looks, it's, but it's so specifically terrible. I highly recommend Perfect Crime. Oh, New York, thank you for Perfect Crime. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going all right.
Awesome. I'm sitting here with the wonderful and golden Matt Dwyer and Baron Vaughn.
Yeah, which one of us is wonderful and which one of us is golden?
Oh, you can find out. We're going to find out through the course of the show.
Okay, good.
I have a little card. I have two cards that say wonderful and golden, and I'll hand them out.
I want to be
really
golden.
Magical. Oh, yeah.
I live by the Outsiders mural in Sherman Oaks.
Oh, my God. Pony Boy and Nature's First Green is gold, right?
Stay gold. Pony Boy.
Stegold Pony Boy. Right, 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 right. And then there's that poem,
which
is Nature's First Grand Thing. I don't know. Is gold. I think it's like Robert Frost or one of those hacks. I don't know. I remember I loved that movie so much as a kid. It like grew up. I mean, I was like, have you seen that movie, Baron?
No.
The Outsiders. It's like C. Thomas Howell and Ralph Macchio. And Ralph Macchio like dies. And Dave, Tom
Patrick
Cruise.
Swayze.
Patrick Swayze.
It's an all-star.
Diane Lane. It's like everybody's in it from like 82, 83. And I like loved it so much. And I loved the book, but you know, and I remember, and then I remember in college, like one night we were like, okay, let's just revisit a movie from our childhood. And we put on The Outsiders and it's unwatchable.
Oh, really?
It's so bad. And it's Coppola directed it, but you know, you're just like, wow.
He did like three S.E. Hinnington.
He did. Cause he did Rumblefish and he did
Tex.
Maybe he did Tex.
With Matt Dillon, I think.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
It was definitely a movie. I don't know if it was. Yeah. Yeah.
It's late
weird.
Coppola.
It was a weird phase for Coppola.
Because
Rumblefish,
yeah.
I revisited.
Rumblefish, I think it's good because it's like an all black and white, and it's like super moody. And
the cinematography is phenomenal.
And these are post Godfather movies.
Yeah.
Because I actually haven't seen much of his. The only thing I can think of that I saw in his later career is Life with Zoe. Do you know that movie?
No.
Yeah, it's on New York Stories.
Yeah, it's a bunch of vignettes.
Okay, no, I don't know that.
That's the only, and I remember being like, this is horrible.
Life with Zoe is in the New York Story thing. It's Woody Allen, Scorsese, and
was
Coppola.
It?
Yeah.
Okay.
Coppola's is a,
okay.
Coppola's I called like it's an after school special with Chanel.
Yeah. Basically.
Chanel the
designer.
The clothes. Okay, great. Okay.
It's just one, like a rich kid in New York.
Yeah, and there's one joke in it that I remember forever. What's the difference between a flautist and a flutist? $50 more per hour.
Oh.
Because she's walking down the street and there's a guy playing the flute, and then he tells her that joke, and I was like, why am I watching this?
And it's done. It's what's his name?
I love that you've held on to that, though, for
so
long.
That's all I remember.
Yeah. That's what you open with on your set, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, always
I always do street jokes. Because every street joke
Coppola movies.
Had a writer.
Yeah, right.
Until the street took it. The street stole it. It's true.
You wonder, like, if that whoever wrote that, like, heard that, or if they were just, I don't know, they were just bored at the computer, like, let's write this in. I don't know. I don't know Coppola that well either. I know, obviously, the Godfather movies are amazing. And
Apocalypse
then
Now.
Apocalypse Now is, of course, is a masterpiece.
The Conversation. Have you seen The Conversation?
I've never seen The Conversation,
Whoa.
And I need to, because
I've seen it. I've seen it a few times.
That's great.
Not
great.
Not to brag.
And that's with, what's his name, who was married to Meryl Streep, right?
Hackman.
Gene Hackman, but also the guy.
John Cazale,
who did. Yes.
He was also in Godfather. He played Fredo.
And Deer Hunter and Dog Day Afternoon.
Yes.
And then he died. Like
he died young.
Did you see the documentary on Cazale?
I don't think he was married to Meryl Streep, but they were like together for the
documentary on Cazale.
No.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah, I gotta
see
that.
I need to, because he was
he's
such an interesting
guy.
Yeah, he was such a great.
What's it called?
Fuck.
That's a weird name for a documentary.
Which is what everybody thought when he died, because he was on the verge.
He
was only in like four or five movies, and they all were major.
And they were great in every single one.
And he was great
one.
In all of them.
I think all of them were nominated for Best Picture.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah, because it's like Dog Day Afternoon. Godfather.
Did you see that Marlon Brando documentary?
I didn't get too far into it.
Listen to me, Marlon.
I'm a little old.
I have not seen that either.
What do you think?
Oh, just the whole, was it Last Tango in Paris thing about...
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible.
So horrible. Yeah. That's so crazy that happened.
But there was a lot of abusive situations women were putting in films.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
The Exorcist, she...
Yes.
Didn't she, like, break bones? They threw her around so much?
Yeah, exactly. And it was also in the 70s vibe of, like, verite. Like, it's got to be real.
Yeah.
Slash, just, like, fulfill our disgusting fantasies with, you know... And you had so many things like that happened.
And it's always under the guise of, I'm trying to catch reality on my camera. It's like, well, you're abusing people without their consent. So.
Yeah, and you're mentally ill, and you're using this as like to work out all this shit. Because it's like, it's so crazy to think that like, oh yeah, we're going to have Brando rape this girl and ruin her life. I mean, it really did ruin her life.
Yes.
And, you know.
Rarely does it improve anyone's life.
Yeah. I guess that was her deal, you know. That's true. I have to admit, I've never quite gotten the Marlon Brando thing. Like Godfather, sure, but like that's one of those things. You're like, oh, it's brilliantly written, it's brilliantly made, and I always thought that like De Niro and everybody else. I mean, it's just like Diane Keaton. They're all, it was just so much more interesting than he just was kind of a.
Well, you know, I actually was a fan of the doc. He sort of invented a new way of acting.
Yes,
for
yes,
film,
for sure.
And
for
what
sure.
he has to say about it in the doc, because the whole doc is like, I had no idea. Well, nobody knew that he had kept all these videotapes for years, just a video. I mean, an audio journal that he had been recording, and then this documentary filmmaker found all the tapes and then put together this doc based on, which is just Marlon Brando talking about his own life, telling himself the story of himself.
Wow, that's great.
Wow.
How
I mean,
did he
I
find
love
him?
That.
He searched a house when he died. Oh. I think he wanted to make a doc, and then he found these tapes in an office. This is the legend I've heard. And he asked the family, do you know what these are? And they're like, no. And he's like, can I listen to them? Yes. And then he listened to them. He's like, this is just him telling himself stuff. This is incredible.
Wow.
I love how people find something like that.
I know.
Like, or like at a garage sale or something.
I know. I mean, I'm just like, you would find like empty Trader Joe's bags in my house. Like, there's like nothing. I mean, I have nothing like that I'd be like, I've been
clearly
secretly
documenting.
Clearly,
he loved Amy's chili.
Exactly. Oh, there's burrito. There's frozen burritos.
So many burritos.
So good.
What do we learn? What do we know about Drew from these Trader Joe's bags?
It's true. It's true. Anyway, but I want to hear. I want to hear things from you guys. Who wants to talk first?
Yeah,
tell
Matt,
me a story.
See, I was under the impression it was tell something you've never told before.
Exactly.
I thought
sharing a personal thing,
a
revelation,
story or like or anything. I mean, it can be big or small. I mean, I leave it open. I just always ask that I don't know what it is before we record, so that makes it more fun for me. And then we go from there. But it doesn't have to be like a major life-changing. Yeah, exactly. Or it could be, if you want to go there.
It could be, but it's just something you never heard of. I'm not good at reading
emails.
You know
what? Really, the reason why, and I've said this a bunch of times, but the reason why I started this show was not to like make earth-shattering, revelations. It's minor revelations, but it's just so that people aren't bored hearing themselves talk, because like we all do a lot of podcasts and everybody kind of talks about the same things.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to do a show where I bring people on and they just say something that they've never said before. But it doesn't have to be like controversial. It doesn't have to be like
just personal, right?
Yeah.
I don't like my family. Well, I'm having
the one that you grew up with.
The one I grew up with, not the one I made. I love the one
I
made. I
would assume that the one you made is like, you're like, I am not going to have them be like these other people that I know.
Yeah. It's very weird, because when you make your own kid, my stomach. I hope that got picked up on the mic.
Got real deep. I hope so.
Stomach
too.
But
is
it's
upset.
Like, it
Keeping
drums that. Up all these.
Yes.
It like I started understanding.
No, continue the sentence. I'm sorry.
Oh no. I began to understand my father better, though he died when I was 12, and I never really liked him, and he was a very angry individual.
Mm-hmm.
And
where'd you grow up again?
I grew up outside Chicago, and then I lived in the city for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was very angry, and his career didn't work out, and he was frustrated. And then when I had my kid, I hadn't worked. I had this skid where I didn't work for like 7 months. And I started understanding my father's anger, and I was like, he wasn't angry at us. He was angry at the world.
The situation.
But
what line of work was your dad in?
He was, when he died, he was working in construction. He drove an asphalt truck and was a laborer.
Okay.
He had an opportunity to be a photographer for one of the Chicago newspapers, because his father worked for the Tribune. And he turned it down, and I think he regretted that his entire life.
Did he think it wasn't manly enough?
I think he wanted to. My dad was, speaking of Marlon Brando, he dressed like Brando in The Wild One when he was a young man. He rode a Harley like year round in Chicago.
Wow.
He wore like, he had his ear pierced in the 50s. Like, he was a real tough guy.
He was a
roustabout.
Yeah. He was. Yeah, he was actually in The Outlaws, the gang.
What?
He was.
Oh, my God.
It was, and my grandfather was a hitman. And so there's like all this violence within my family. And I'm the least.
This is like an Arthur Miller play. This is fascinating.
I've been trying to figure out, because I'm like the least.
This is such a story. This is amazing. And then, so he just felt really. Just like, you know, like he deserved, you know,
better.
And he was
American
pretty
dream.
Angry. And I don't know. It's like weird to say you don't like. I do like pockets of my family, but this, I've never been able to connect with them.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest brother and some of my nieces and nephews. But it's like this very. I'm sure I'm not alone in the world.
Can I mean, that's why we, you know, a lot of it is why we all do what we
can
do.
Can I submit an idea on that?
Yeah.
You're a creative person.
I am.
I think that might be why.
Yeah. Well, because you're right. Yeah.
You, to be a creative person means to see outside of what everyone is telling you is true and what everyone is telling you is right. And sometimes it's just you have an innate sense of it, or you're in a situation in which it's been forced on you. People are trying to force you to be something, and you go, this isn't me. This isn't what's right. This isn't who I am. And then it kind of takes you outside of that. And once you start to disengage from the spell, if you will, wake up from the American dream, you realize everybody else is asleep. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hands in on three. Revolution.
Yeah. Revolution.
I was got the shit kicked out of me a lot as a kid.
That helps.
And I think I sort of created, I don't know, I'm trying to have...
Were you in like a, I mean, were like in a like rough neighborhood or was there like...
It wasn't rough. It was a kind of trashy suburb. There was something about me people like to hit, but it...
Wow, that's so crazy.
But I mean, like,
sense your
sensitivity. My father, a couple times, and then my brother, like, beat the fuck out of me, and then the neighborhood kids beat the fuck out of me, and, like, I got handcuffed to a railing at a party in junior high and stripped naked, and, like, was left to just sort of be there for everybody's entertainment. And you know what? That's why I went into showbiz. That run would, you're unsafe.
Nothing will be worse than that. Like, no crowd will ever be worse than this, you know.
As a defense mechanism, I started calculating everything ahead, I think. Like, I would see every scenario and, like, how it would go south. Yep. But I think that's part of the reason I got the fuck out of there, because I was like,
well,
you stick in this cesspool, and you're going to end up being one of the pools of cess.
Well, you also learn how you learn how to be funny really fast. You're like, what do I have? What do I have in my corner
that
I can use? You know, because that was definitely mine too. I was like, oh, if I make everybody laugh, they won't hit me or hate me.
Yes.
You know, and I won't be. You know, my other secret weapon, because I grew up in the South, was that I made people think I was possessed by the devil, and that actually and I actually worked.
How old were you when you did that?
Oh, that was like junior high when I was like sort of, and I would just act like I had this like demon inside me, and they believed it, or they would stay away from me because I made people think I was just crazy.
Right.
Because I was like, if they really think you're crazy, you're not just like
you're unpredictable,
exactly, and that they can't really, and they're truly scared. And I just saw how scared everybody was of the devil, and I was like, oh, this is easy. Come on. But it's so fascinating that, you know, that I totally agree with Baron. Like, when you're a creative person, you do, you know, there are different ways of dealing with it. I mean, some people get really quiet and introspective and hang out in their room and write a lot, and that other people like do a lot of drugs and, you know, and numb the pain or whatever. But like everyone, you know,
hey,
you react
both.
In some. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I didn't expect to say that when I start my conversation off that way, saying that thing about my family. But
I love you're like, I don't really know what to say. Okay, I hate my family. I'm like, that's huge.
It's something I've been struggling with because there's born again Christian Trump voters in my family,
And I just like same in mine.
Got into it with my aunt after the election. I'm like, you're not welcome in my life. Like, I have a gay nephew. Half my family is Mexican, and I have a nephew that's half Asian and Mexican. And I'm like, you voted against your family. Like, fuck you and saying it's the economy. You took a shot at your own family.
Mm-hmm.
So fuck off. You're not welcome.
Right.
Mm. Ooh,
right.
There was anger in there.
Well, you know, but
it's also like a thing where you're like, you don't get to have it both ways. Like, you know, if you voted against like human rights, basically, then you don't get these humans in your life. Like, I mean, I understand that completely. And I have some friends. I mean, I have a friend, Jackie Beat, who's done the show before and who's a big drag queen. And she was saying at the top of her show that anybody voted for Trump, you're not welcome at my show. And it kind of like gets a laugh. She's like, no, I'm serious. Like, if you voted for him, you don't get to laugh at this clown, at this, you know, because that's the thing when they go, well, we're going to go laugh. This is entertaining to us. Yeah, we're going to, you know, vote against your survival. And that's, you know, I get it. I totally get it.
I feel like if you're not actively in my life and enriching it and adding to my life and you're causing that kind of problem.
Yeah.
fuck off. I don't need you.
And do you think also having a kid like adds to that feeling as well? Because you're like, this is what's important. This is what, you know, I have to focus on my family and I don't have to be nice to everybody. And
yeah, you know. I mean, I have a daughter. So the sexist bullshit that goes along with Donald Trump.
Sure. Just,
I mean, I used to hold my daughter with pure joy. And now there's this holding her and also just. There's fear now.
Sure.
Right.
And not that the world is a safe place to begin with, but now it's really not a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I view everything totally different, mm-hmm. and it mm-hmm. terrifies me. Mm-hmm.
How old is your daughter?
She just turned one a couple months ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not a parent, but obviously I've thought about doing that, and I have many, many friends that are parents that are from different styles of parenting, and their kids are, and this woman who's a friend of mine, her children were about 14 and 16, and no, actually they were 12 and 14, and I remember thinking, how are these kids so well socialized that they just seemed like to have this sense of themselves that I didn't have when I was mm-hmm. their age? And I remember asking her about her parenting style, and she was talking about, she said, I always tell my children the truth. She's like, it might not be the whole truth because they're two, mm-hmm. you know, but I give them a version of it that I think they can handle, but I never lie. And then when they come back to me about that at six, I can layer it in with new information that I know they can handle. Then they come back at 10 and then I can layer more new information. So I'm always building on the ground of truth. It's just I leave things out until they come back and they're like, wait a minute, you didn't explain this. And she said this thing about imposing oneself on her children, which I thought was really interesting, because she said, like, a lot of parents will go out to the beach with the kid, right? And she's like your son will go in the water, and one parent might be like, don't go in the water, it's cold. Mm-hmm. But what you've done right there is you've robbed your child of their own experience. You've told them what you think of the water. She's like, so I'd see my son go in the water and he'd come back and I'd be like, oh, I thought the water was cold. What do you think? And then suddenly he has to report to me.
That's great.
His own feelings. And that's then he's amazing. Always got this authorship, you know, and this authority, this agency to say what he needs to say, and knows that I love him no matter what he has to say.
Yeah.
So when he disagrees with me, he can speak it. Or when I disagree with him, I can speak it.
That's what we're, I mean, it's, she's a year old, but we're trying to cultivate
that. Yeah.
My wife is, my wife is very much a skeptical thinker. She's very into science, and she's mm-hmm. like, we're trying to instill, even at this age, influence that sort of thing of like, think for yourself. And we're like, you know, we want to do Santa Claus, but I'm like, but we're going to do it. And then if she figures it out, we're going to use that as a tool to teach about how there's no God.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, like, your father had this anger, mm-hmm. which was a response to the situation that he was in. And your response to the situation that you're in is more of a fearful response. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like you witnessed your father have that anger and it turned you off from him. Not that your fear will turn your daughter off, but you at least have an awareness of what's going on.
Yeah.
As to what your father
part of it, yeah. too. Because that's the thing that, like, you know, we see how we were raised and I see with my brother has two kids and I see how he's raising them. As a complete, reflection of how we were, in terms of like, this is, you know, we were told, don't do this, don't do that, don't mm-hmm. ask why. It was a lot of like, these are the rules. And the more you challenge the rules, exactly. And the more you question authority, the more things we're going to take away from you. So we're teaching you, don't challenge, don't make any sort of, you know, just go with what we tell you to do and be sweet. And even to this day, you know, my mom decides to, you know, tell my brother and me, to just be safe, to not say anything that's going to piss anybody off, to just, like, you know, not everybody needs to hear your opinion all the time, you know, because she operates in fear, and she's still, you know, when I go home, you know, I'll be 40 years old in a few weeks, but it doesn't matter. I'm her son, and it's like she's terrified of anything bad happening to me when I'm home. And but yeah, it doesn't allow you to have any sort of like personality or say in it. And and my brother was so rebellious and outspoken, and he got into it with my dad so much because he was just like, why? And my whole vibe was, you guys are all crazy. I'll be in my room. I was like, I have a book to read. I'll be upstairs, and I'm being like, I'm getting out of here real soon. And my brother's was, I need to argue about everything. And so I see with his kids, he's very much like what you're talking about, how he's just like, he really wants his kids to have an opinion and it does create a lot of, maybe, because I mean, when I go see them, I'm like, love these kids so much, but sometimes I'm like, just tell them no. Smack them. And I'm like, I don't have kids, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes you just are like, I don't know what the right answer is because, but it is really interesting. And I think the key in terms of the evolution is the awareness is like, okay, we're aware. No one's perfect. I'm operating from this place. We're all emotional and we're doing the best we can. I mean, the greatest thing about when you do get older and you can look back at your parents and go, they were really doing the best they can. You think as a kid, like, they are God. They are everything. How could they let me down? Or how could they do this to, and you get older and you're like, oh my God, they just had to make a decision or whatever. And
yeah, they're people.
They're people. And then so you're like, but they didn't really, there was no self-reflection. There was no sense of, the reason I did this is because I'm this kind of a person. I mean, also.
And there was no value even thinking about things in that way.
Oh, God, no. If anything, it was like, we don't challenge that. Don't question that. For me, it was like, I was always, overdramatic. And it was like, we don't need to sit down and, going to therapy was like you were chewing leaves off a fence somewhere. Like if you had to go to therapy, you were crazy, and you would never talk about your feelings. It was just sort of like, you say what's going to make everybody else comfortable around you and what's going to make people happy and what's a polite thing to say. Manners, I'm thrilled that I was taught manners, but there's other times that I'm like, no, let's not have manners about this. Let's actually, this is actually fucked up. And come on, and it's our families are,
they're complex.
They are. And it is really hard. And it is really hard to, in the world that we're in now. And I mean, I have family who, are not overtly sexist, racist, homophobic people, but voted for Trump and think that he's going to be wonderful for the country. And there's no telling them, anything else.
I don't get what people and think is going to be so wonderful.
I don't either.
It's reactionary.
And it's also fear. It's also like the idea that I don't know why. I mean, just this whole thing with, the economy, it's like the economy's never been better.
But it's true of in the history of the world that when there's a disconnect between fact and what people think is happening and they want someone to blame for why they don't have what they have, someone shows up who says, you know whose fault it is? This group of people over here, once upon a time it was Jews. Once upon a time it was Hungarians, then it was, now it's Mexicans and Muslims.
Right.
So it's like, that is what a demagogue is. And now we have one as a president. Anyway, happy day.
Yeah.
Oh,
anyway,
hard not to be in fear in this time.
No, it is. And look,
but it is. It's really hard not to be. And it's like, I think that the thing is, because, to me, like I'm with him, I'm just scared of his unpredictability.
Yes.
I'm like, I can deal with evil. I can deal. We've seen the face of, we've had Reagan, who was horrible, who was the worst. We had Nixon, who was disgusting. We've had, George
Truman.
Do you think he'll
George
go down?
Bush.
Do you think he's going to get kicked out of office?
I do. I think very quickly.
Who? Trump?
Trump.
Yes.
Well, I mean, Mike Pence is not peas and carrots.
He's not, but he's a scary guy. But he is more in the vibe. He's an evil we can deal with. He's an evil that we know. Trump is unpredictable, because he's such a dandy and he doesn't believe anything he says, which is so terrifying.
He just has to win in the moment.
And he has to, and I'm like, oh, he's going to start nuclear war. Or he's going to start this major shit with somebody because he loves the drama. And so we get rid of that person. I think they're going to. I think what's going to happen is the Republicans are going to get rid of him, and they're going to come in and say, "We did it. Hillary couldn't do it. The Democrats couldn't do it. We saved the day. So you're welcome, everybody. Here's your hero." Which is like, okay, fine. Then we'll fight that battle. But
even if they do that, there's still a lot of people who voted for this guy, who believe in this guy, well, who believe every time he says it's rigged against me, if they get him out of there, there's going to be this insanely crazy...
It's going to blow up like crazy because I think we have three groups of people now. We have us...
The three of us, literally just the three.
The three of us.
The three of us.
And we're never
room.
Leaving the studio.
Lots of, lock the door.
You call it sound booth, we call it bunker.
And then we have the Republicans and then the Trumpets. Like, the Trump people aren't behind the Republicans, and the Republicans aren't behind the Trump people. So when this happens, these Trump supporters are going to lose their minds. And they're going to. So that's what the Republicans don't realize is that it's going to blow up
in their face.
Yes. I think that's true. I think the core of Trump supporters who are those crazies, I think, is relatively small. I do think there is a big pocket of them, people who voted because
that's
poor
not my family. My family is not crazy like that.
A lot of rich people did. I mean, like,
I know.
It's that whole
Beverly Hills
poor thing.
The city of Beverly Hills. If you look at the numbers,
really?
They voted overwhelmingly for Trump.
Wow. I have a different theory about Pence, though, because I kind of feel like the Republicans, they hired that intelligent agent to find the dirt about him.
Yes,
so I think they knew no one else could be Clinton but maybe Trump. So, and I'm at the beginning conspiracy theory here, but I think
we're living in a conspiracy.
Isn't it weird? Like, you live in a time
where we're House of Cards right now. Like, we're in the middle of it.
But I feel like Pence won't be able to get reelected. So I think if Trump goes down, it seems like they're already priming Ryan. Like, why did Ryan do a town hall?
They're priming. The other thing, too, is if Trump goes down, someone explained to me yesterday that Pence will go down with him because that's who Trump selected.
Yeah.
So it doesn't automatically go to the vice president.
True.
It will
go
to the Speaker of the House, and it will be Paul Ryan.
That's right, because the Speaker is third in line.
It feels like it's headed there. Even if Pence stays in, I think Pence will be like, I'm going to stay VP, and because they want Ryan, because he's reelectable.
Yes, absolutely. He's, you know.
He's the face of the Republican Party that
is
the one
that they
think.
It's a handsome
one, isn't it? No, really gorgeous.
He's got two first names.
Oh, I like that. Just like child stars and porn stars.
He looks like a cartoon. Like, it looks like a caricature of somebody, actually.
Like if you drew a caricature of a politician.
Except for them fucking guns he's got.
I don't know that he has eyeballs. He has this gorgeous face, and there's these hollow black enclaves in his eyes that are, it's very...
That's what happens when you have no soul.
What's that movie with Pan's Labyrinth? That's what he sort of looks like. That guy.
Oh, with the eyes and the hands?
Yeah, he has the eyes and the
hands.
At
the feast?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, mix that
great
with
nightmarish,
like,
image.
With Superman. That's Paul Ryan.
Do you think, though, that this... I kind of think this could F the Republican Party.
I hope so.
Yeah. Because it's like everyone's talking about how the Democrats are licking their wounds and trying to rebuild, and that's true, but
they're both
disarray.
But I do think, and I really hope, and I'm optimistic about this, but the thing that Democrats always get wrong is anger. Like, we don't get angry enough.
I agree.
We roll over and we go, oh, well, we're going to be bigger people.
Well, because we see it as stooping to the level.
Absolutely.
If we get angry, then we're doing it like we're fighting like they are.
No one was happier when Michelle Obama said, you know, when they go low, we go high. I was like, yes, that's amazing. But now you're like, fuck no, we gotta get angry
like that
and
during
get in
the,
there.
During the debates, because I felt like it looked like Trump was walking all over and people were like, and Hillary's like, well, go high. And I'm like, you gotta shut this fucking guy down.
And this is the reason why we, you know, I mean, it's like, we need to admit we were arrogant and we were like, you know, we were like, this is never going to happen, but it did. And so now it's like, okay, now we need to organize and get angry. And all this shit Republicans have been trying to do, they haven't gotten so far because people are getting like active and they're talking and they're screaming, and that's what I hope is going to be happening.
Yeah. That's my other fear, is that if Trump goes down, people are going to be like, okay, we can relax, and then they're going to get really sneaky.
Exactly.
But that's the thing, because all this brings up the themes of, what the hell is the point of a government? What the hell is the point of a political party? Because if we have to fight dirty to get votes, then it just becomes about consolidating power and being in power. And that's not the same as being representative of the desires of the population, of being able to do things for the people of this country and make it so that way people can prosper. That's totally different than just getting votes.
Yeah, because the Republicans aren't representing the people, even the ones that voted for... It's like, they're just...
They're literally misrepresenting
the
people.
It's a corporate fuck party.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Completely. Completely.
But that's a whole... Obviously, we can just talk about this forever.
I know.
And
I
like,
love it.
We're never, in a room talking. Yeah.
I know, exactly. Like, we're right. But I love talking about this.
Well, you know...
It's fascinating. And I think it's good.
Yeah.
I mean, for years, people always complain about Americans that you would go to Europe and like the kids, the teenagers would talk politics and they were really involved in what was going on. And we had no idea like what was going on. We're like, I know who the president is. Maybe. You know, and now...
Chrétien, is that who it is?
And now we are, you know, sadly in this horrible, terrifying place, but we're talking about it and we're getting, you know, and I think it's good. And I think it's, you know, how dare you tell anyone with a voice not to be political right now? You know, we all need to be like in the middle of this because we are. It's our lives. And you're right. It's like these people who are actively going against, you know, laws and things that were set up to help people live their lives. If you're going against that, to what end is that about other than power? You know, how are you a government? How are you like, you know, that's the thing that makes me crazy. It's like when something's already been set, like, you know, Roe versus Wade and marriage equality, you're going to go and the, you know, Affordable Health Care Act, like you're going to go against, like we've already established these things. You're going to go against them just to take this away from people. Just
and who
because.
Are you taking it away from? I mean, like
a lot of people.
I mean, the poor. I mean, most of this stuff is
and
just
how are you winning? How are you winning? Because God? Because Jesus?
Because
like,
they're flagging. They're stoking the fires of
not,
fear.
And it's not even that. Yes, exactly. And it's just power. It's using that to get the power.
You know, I read this really weird article the other day. Not a weird article. It was just an article. But it actually, what you were saying about your dad kind of reminded me of it. It was interesting because it was basically an article that their premise is that the unemployment rate is actually not that bad. There are a lot of jobs, but you keep hearing about all these men who are like, I don't have my job. And they're saying it's because we have these ideas of manliness, these patriarchal mm-hmm. ideas. Mm-hmm. So these men are waiting for jobs that are men's jobs because they're refusing to learn a new skill,
right.
a new trade to apply that to a job that they see as a quote unquote woman's job.
Uh-huh.
So they're sitting around waiting for a job that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
So they can feel like they're manly men. Just kind of like a nursing, that's for women. Call me when jackhammers are involved.
Yeah.
And that's basically
so
what's
interesting.
Happening.
I think that's so true because it's like, you know, there is that pride that's completely a construct. It's like,
and it turns into entitlement, which turns 100%. Into scapegoating, which turns into Trump.
You know, and you exactly. And when you deal with, you know, no offense, Matt, straight white men, because get out, Matt. But I mean, like,
I don't have the white part, so I can shame you.
Exactly.
That's why I voted for Trump.
Straight black man. I mean,
so yeah, Barry and I each get one thing that takes us away from it. But it's like, but they don't understand what being other is, and so they just truly don't even. And it's like so. There's that sense of like, but what about me? That's what the entitlement is.
They're being othered for, they were othered for a year.
Exactly. And they're just like, wait a minute. You know, it's like, you know, the kid that has 10 toys and it's like, you can't play with all 10 of those toys. Give one of them to somebody else. No, but that toy's mine. I, you know, and it's that idea that they don't quite, you know, and it's not conscious. It's not a thing that like, but it's interesting when it's about what jobs they will take, you mm-hmm. know, as opposed to like how they're defined and how they see themselves and, you know, the kind of, but you're right. All these jobs have been replaced with machines, but that's the history of the world. Like, you know, like
we, you adjust
how things happen, you know, exactly.
Like, you pivot like an app.
So exactly. Like the reason we have an iPhone is because things changed, you know, or whatever. Like we have these things because, you know, so that's really fascinating.
Do you think it's interesting? Because I was reading an article about this yesterday, but like everyone after the election, they're like, well, it's because of the poor white people in the rural, and we ignored them. It's like, and then they made it seem like the cities are this festival of rich.
Uh-huh.
And it's
I know.
Like, we've ignored, there's plenty of parts of the city that we've ignored.
Oh, yeah.
It's 100%.
Like, it's like this, the narrative is very biased and strange.
Yes.
Well, that's what's weird is that, like, again, this is cognitive dissonance. There's a gap between what is actually actually happening mm-hmm. and what people feel is happening. Mm-hmm. And what people feel is happening has become more important than facts.
Yes.
So all these people feel as if they're being ignored, even though they're not, but that's going to make them vote in a certain way.
Well, it comes down to, I just didn't like Hillary Clinton. You know, and that's the mentality of like, no matter what you'd say about her, we didn't like her, she's out. You know, if you don't like, you know, I just have a feeling. It's that same idea.
Yeah, that's my mom. She didn't vote.
One spent their life serving people.
Right.
And the other...
career politician.
Yeah.
Because that's a bad thing. How? Like,
but also,
that a bad thing?
There is an exhaustion, because it's like, if you think about it, for the last 20 years, this country's been deciding between a Bush or a Clinton.
100%.
So it's
and
like
I have to admit,
dynasty.
I will say, first of all, I could not wait to run to the polls at 7 a.m. and immediately vote for her. So I 100% voted for her and supported. But I really had to get there. I had to really work through it, because I had a lot of issues with her, and we all did. But that's I think part of all of our outrage. It's like we were able to get this or what we have now, and we have what we have now.
Right.
You know, we wouldn't be dealing with this with Hillary. We would not be. I have a lot of problems with things that she said and done, and the legacy of with her husband, and a lot of stuff that was, you know, and there are plenty of documentaries you want to watch. You're like, oh, the Clintons were basically Republicans that basically
right,
shifted
right.
it over.
She's the most Republican candidate.
And you know, and so it's all that stuff that you're like, but. Ugh.
And I think that's supposed to be the point of who you assign to be on your cabinet, is that for what your shortcomings are, you said, you know what, I'm not that good at education, so I'm going to appoint this person, right? This person who's
exactly.
really good at education.
Right.
That's why people are all upset about who it is that Donald Trump is choosing, because it's like, he said he's going to do this, but it's all these Wall Street mofos, and then the most racist motherfucker in the world, Steve motherfucking Bannon.
Oh, the worst.
Anyway.
I know.
Well,
anyway,
at least we're going to get to the bottom of autism.
Yes. So, Barron,
tell me
a story. Talk to me. What is something you haven't ever, I don't know.
Oh, you know, something I've been thinking about a lot lately, because we were talking about fear. I have been thinking a lot about, because this also goes back to what Matt was saying about being bullied in when he was younger, is how long I've been walking around this planet with this constant fear for my own physical safety.
Wow,
that
really?
I walk down the street because of where I grew up. I walk down the street.
Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And so I'm constantly thinking about being robbed. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly thinking about being shot. I'm constantly thinking about being stabbed. And that's just from strangers on the street. And then if it's a police person, then I'm like, well, I'm definitely getting shot. So it's just like I have been walking around with this fear of I'm going to be killed at any moment. For so long, and it's like I'm starting to see how much I've just put it into, I've just embedded it in all these different ways that I do things. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing this thing about, you know, because women, of course, fear for their physical safety.
Sure.
And adjust their lives accordingly because of it. Don't park. They park a certain distance from a place. You know, mm-hmm. there's a certain walk from the front door to the car. It's like all these things that they have to think about. And then I remember reading something about that. I'm like, I think about things that way. I'm constantly be like, how can I not get stabbed when I'm going to walk into this bar? Not get stabbed in the bar. When I'm walking out of the bar, make sure that I'm walking in a certain way. When I go into a store, I'm like in a certain position with my hands in a certain way, so that because I know I'm being watched at all moments. So it's like, and then home wasn't safe as a kid either, because there was abuse happening as a child. So it was like I wasn't safe outside, and I wasn't safe inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm still trying to adjust my mind to let those things go, which is difficult.
Gosh, I mean, how do you even begin to start adjusting to that?
Well,
or like around that, like, I mean, not.
Well, a life lived in fear is not a life.
Right.
So it's like, I can be afraid, and sure, there's all these great reasons, and there's plenty of justifications, and I can point to all sorts of things that have happened that have made that happen, but I'm not going to be good. Like, if I'm just sitting there shaking in fear all the time, that's not a life. That's not a life mm-hmm. worth living. So it's like just letting it go and being like, I have to. That's what the whole point of rights are, is that everyone just wants to be a person who can walk down the damn street.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And go to dinner, walk into a store, see their family, and just be okay. And anything that's in your way of being okay, technically, is an oppression, is some sort of oppression. When people are judging you based on literally nothing that you can't, because you, how you look or how you dress or how whatever. So it's like letting, seeing that that is a, that is a power that has been put on me. I'm not responsible for what's being put on me. You know, that's the world saying all those things about myself, and I've internalized them. That's what this fear is. It's me internalizing racism. It's me internalizing abuse and being like, these things are facts, therefore I have to adjust accordingly. They're not facts.
Right.
These things are not real in the sense that, oh, they're not true. They're real.
I was going to say,
but they're not
like,
true.
You have reason. You have every reason to have that fear.
Rent is real. It isn't true. Right? There's, we've been alive since before there was rent.
Yes.
But now we have to deal with it. It's real.
Right. Sure. Sure. It is so crazy because it can take over everything, the fear, and just being
it can.
Like, and you know, just having to realize like fate is such a big part, and like, and being like, you know what, my fate is whatever's meant to be is meant to, like, I try, you know, and think in that way as, and some fear is really good and health and healthy and smart. It's like, yeah, like, because all that stuff that you're talking about happens, you know? And so it's like, you can't just go, I'm just not going to care. I'm just going to, you know, cause like, well, that's the moronic. I mean, like, you know, in the world that we live in now, but but you're right. It is crippling if you let it have that sort of hold, you know? I mean, just right now is, and I'm just telling you guys before we were recording, I have painted fingernails because I'm in the Golden Girls live on stage because I'm doing important art, you know, with my life. And, but we do these, you know, we do these like episodes of the Golden Girls, and I walk around for like a week with painted fingernails. And I also know that like I, you know, most people can like, you know, if they pay attention, they can, you know, they're like, oh, this guy's gay. Probably. But probably not. I mean, it's like, I think about like that when I went the other day, you know, to get a sandwich and I have these, you know, painted fingernails on, the looks I got and the weirdness. And I was like, oh, I'm being treated this, you know, and this is real. This is actually happening. If I walked into a store every time and I was like, hi, I'm a homosexual, I'd like coffee. You know what I mean? What that does. But you know, it's different because I can choose not to reveal that. Like, you know, it's like, why would I? And, you know, there's also that thing. But I'm just saying, I understand it's different because
isn't that what in the closet is?
Yes.
Is someone choosing not to reveal a truth about themselves.
It's true. And it's like, it's not just like, oh, I've told my friends and family that I'm gay. It's like in the world, you know, a lot of times it's not interesting to me to tell everybody, you know, or like present or whatever. It's like, who cares? Like, you know, it's like, we'll move on, you know.
Well, it's not a big deal. It's only a big deal when it's a big deal to someone who wants to hurt you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because of it.
Right. But, you know, I mean, I have a choice whether I want to reveal that or not. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I understand for you, you don't in a way that if somebody is going to go, you know.
I used to have a joke where I said I came out to my parents as black to address that exact sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
They're like, what? But you've been listening to nothing but Kenny Loggins.
But yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that's like, you know, that is, you know. And there is no, I mean, who has the answer to how you deal with that? But it's like, it's such a.
Well, but that is sort of the thing, that there isn't one answer. And I think that the key to it is finding out for yourself what the answer is, because you have to kind of accept that you're in this place, or I have to accept that I'm in a place of fear, and then thinking about, what is it that I've experienced that put this on me? Mm-hmm. And then recognizing that some of those things, you know, especially if they're childhood stuff, it's over.
Right.
It's over. I don't have to carry it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm an adult. That sucks. I do not have to project these things onto every person that walks towards me. Because then you're just always suspicious of everyone. And then you actually, in that place, you can't actually tell who you should and shouldn't be suspicious of. If everyone is equally culpable,
absolutely.
Then when people are actually dangerous, it's hard to tell.
Absolutely.
Because everyone's dangerous somehow.
Right.
So
and
it's
also,
like,
like, for me, just assuming that people are going to like me and accept me when I meet them, like, until proven otherwise, is also helpful instead of the opposite. Instead
yes.
of going, you're gonna judge me, you're gonna think I'm different or whatever. Just going like, everyone likes me when I walk into a room, and I'm, you know, and they, I'm give you no reason not to. And then if we have a thing, it'll be that thing that I have with you specifically.
As opposed to humanity.
Just like walking out the front door and going, who am I going to take down now? You know?
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I think that's it is a thing, because when I was younger and it was as simple as I didn't want to get beat up. Right. I wanted to have the control over what people were laughing at.
Sure.
And I knew that if I was funny, then I'm liked.
Yep.
Then there's always going to be somebody, when someone's about to punch me, be like, hey, you can't actually punch Baron. We like him.
Right.
That's what that was my thing in my head, is like, if I'm funny to someone, sure. if someone likes me, that's one of these kids that they respect.
Yep.
Then when they go to like, I can't, so-and-so who's higher ranked than I am on the bully hierarchy likes you, so I guess I can't do anything.
Right.
Because they'll beat me up.
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to parties, or I'd ditch out of parties for years, because I would, because that fear, I brought that fear, because most of my,
you were
a lot
also
of my
handcuffed to it. Like,
yeah, that's, I mean, that's traumatizing,
that's
Matt.
Like, that makes sense. Like, why you would be like, you know,
I get anxious, and
that's Dwyer circumstances.
Yeah, I still like get anxious in group settings.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And it's like why we all do what we do. Exactly. It makes total sense. It's like, you know, people who are too well adjusted and liked and included forever. I'm like, good for you. You're probably not going to be funny. You'll be funny to everyone in the room. Like, you'll be that
yeah.
person, but you're probably not going to do that with your life. And I'm sure you'll be very happy and everything's fine. But,
yeah.
You know, you'll be fine. You'll be fine for a living, which is one way to live. But it's, you know, I embrace that, and I'm thankful that I'm not fine. You know what I mean? I embrace the, like, the insecurities and the bullshit and all the baggage that I have. I'm like, oh, that's what makes me, like,
you
do what I do.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have any of this. I wouldn't have, you know, any teeth. Otherwise, I would just be this kind of whoop, 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 kind of, you know, whatever, you know, a medium person. Let's not be medium people.
I can't imagine medium people don't stew at their cubicle or whatever and be like, fuck, I should have done anything else. Like,
oh.
It's not like they're most, I think most people are born with dreams and desires.
I do too. I also think though that most people just, I don't know. I feel so arrogant when I talk about it, because I feel so like, well, the drones, but like, you know, it's just interesting though, how people see things. It's just like they kind of know they're going to have a job they hate. They're going to be married to somebody that they're okay with. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, and we're going to have these kind of, we're just going to trudge through. And I do think, I mean, I don't know. Yes, I think that, yeah. I mean, I think people are born with hopes and dreams, but I don't know that.
But the power to fit in.
Yeah.
There are things to be in place.
There are things that are
powerful.
Bigger than that for people. You know, they just look at it as hopes and dreams. That's the other thing, too. They don't see it as a reality ever. They don't ever see it as like, oh, that could actually do that. They're like, well, yeah, I really want to do this. But, you know, I would
never
do
that.
Yeah,
I guess I'm in a bit of a bubble in that world. Because I knew what I wanted to do as a kid. And I started taking classes at Second City in high school. And I was immediately in a diverse and, like, encouraging. Mm-hmm. And, like, everybody was a fucking weirdo.
Right.
And it was like, I would go leave the suburbs to go hang out at Second City. And it was like, I had to travel 40, 50 miles to find, like, comfort.
Yeah.
Now, that brings up what I was going to say, which is that I would assume all of us had tricky-ish relationships with our family. And then I think that sometimes what the impulse for creative people is to go find the new family.
Yes.
Is to go find the
yes.
group of people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as some Native Americans might call it, the totem family.
Totem. Mm. Where did you go?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I went to a performing arts high school. Mm-hmm. In Vegas, and that became my solace. And then I went to theater school in Boston. So it was like, and then I started doing stand up when I was in Boston. So it was like, I got to go to school and be around people that knew me and didn't judge me.
Right.
And then I go home and be afraid, you know, and be,
yeah.
be like with the people
sure.
that I didn't feel understood me. And then I'd go to school and be understood. So I had to go to school to be understood. And for a lot of people, it's the opposite, you know? And I think that a lot of these people who a lot of people do grow up in good families and whatever, and they have the support, and that's why the dreams aren't important necessarily to them, because their family is so supportive of them that they feel unafraid.
Yeah.
They know they can fall on their face, but they're going to be picked up. They're going to be taken care of and nurtured. Whereas I think a lot of people grow up not knowing that, feeling like, oh, this is the group of people that are blood related to me do not support me. So I got to go find those people that do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always had a very loving and supporting family, big picture, you know. And I was always encouraged, but never felt like understood. I never felt really seen, you know. So for me, the difference was you all love me and support me. You're like, they always saw that I was smart and they're like, you can do whatever you want. And then when I told them, like, oh, I'm going to, you know, be an actor, you know, a comedian, like, that was so weird to them. They're like, what? That? You know? And so I was like, oh, you haven't paid it. You know, they're all very loud and they're all very funny. I'm the quiet one in my family. So the fact that I would do comedy for a living is, like, to this day, I think, kind of baffling to some people, like, especially a more extended family that may not know me as well, or they've come to know me, like, through my work as an adult. But as a kid growing up, my humor was weird. It was quiet. It was different. And I never felt like I had an audience there. And so that was always, for me, it was always like I had a community theater that I went and I was the only kid. I mean, there were a couple people, that teenagers, that did community theater, but like I was directing at the community theater when I was in high school, and I was directing, like, you know, 40-year-old plumbers teachers. And I was like so bossy, and because it was like, I have so much power here, and I loved it. And I was like, I'm good at this. So yeah, that was the same thing. And it was like, for me, like, you know, moving out here and like finding the groundlings and going, oh, these are actually like-minded people. And even, you know, theater department in college and before that and all that, you know. So yeah, you do find your second family. And then I also, you know, it's a lot of it with my gay friends. I mean, I have a gay family that is like unbelievable. Like, we have found each other from different, you know, and talk about that and how we get together once a year in Palm Springs. We just got back and stay at a house in Palm Springs, and we are just like watch pajamas and drink wine and watch movies all day.
We're on a family vacation.
It's a family vacation. And it's the easiest, like there's no, it's, you know, and it's that sense of like, oh, we were like, well, you guys must have so much fun. I'm like, I guess we, it is so much fun, but we don't really do anything. We don't, you know, we're relaxed around each other. And there's that thing where you're like, we get each other on a level that, you know, and I, you know, I think a lot of it, I don't have any regrets about anything anywhere now. I mean, I'm very happy about that. I don't hate my family for Matt. No, I'm kidding. No, but I mean, like, I don't turn around and, you know, I don't have that, but I think from an early age, I was like, okay, I love these people love me, but There's something, you know, isolating. A lot of it I did to myself. You know, I can say I was the one that I, you know, my brother was way more actively involved in a lot of part of the family than I was. I was sort of, you know, not into, because
So
you know, we a lot of it we do it ourselves. A lot of it's protection, like inherently, like I have to take care of this thing that I am or that people don't quite get or whatever, but it's like, you know, I'm very happy that I saw that at an early age. I feel lucky that I saw that at an early age, because a lot of people don't have that. But I think you're right, if you do fit in, if you are so supported and you like you join the family business, or you know, you take the first job offer after out of college, or you're just, you know, you go along, it's easier, you know, and if it's easy for you, I totally understand why things, you know, and then people have the crises midlife, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then when they go, wait a minute, I thought I was going to get all these things. And it's like, you know, that you haven't really been paying attention along the way.
Yeah.
What's going on and with you. You haven't even asked yourself who you are, you know, but a lot of people don't have to. A lot of people never have to examine their lives. And it's all we do all the time.
Yes.
To an annoying degree.
Yes.
Yeah. I drive my wife fucking crazy.
We all do.
Because I externalize it too.
Yes. Sure.
Well, you know, it's time. Our relationship to time is complex because it's linear. And we're always thinking about time as something we're running out of instead of something that we still have. So it's like things are cyclical. But we think if I don't get it by this time, then when I get to this place, I'm not going to have the thing. But you can kind of always achieve what you want to achieve if you really want to. It doesn't matter, you know, because again, this is it's almost like a response to Hollywood in a way, because, you know, they value certain way of being, mm-hmm. a certain style of looking, a certain style of sounding, and people get picked because they fit the mold. And when you're outside of the mold and you feel like you're being forgotten about, you're falling through the cracks. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of, like, the stuff that I'm making for myself now, it's mostly because I realized that I was complaining constantly about how I wasn't seeing myself or anything like me, and then I realized, well, I gotta make it.
Absolutely.
I gotta make
same
the
hair.
Cracks,
same hair.
The
That's
sidewalk.
How I've done everything. Yeah,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I feel like... I've the only successes I've had, with the exception of maybe writing for Jonah's show, is like is shit that I had to do myself, because it's like I would look around the comedy scene and like somebody would come around Comedy Death Ray or something, and then like they'd do one show and it was like they got anointed.
Exactly.
And it's like, and then, I always was like, hey, I'm here too.
River. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and the three of us have been out doing this for a long time, and we like that's a badge of honor. At a certain point, we're like, "Good, look, we're still, you know, doing
still kicking."
This. But you're right; you have to make your own stuff and say, you know, that's why I, you know, every bit of for me, like everything that I've that people would even maybe know me for is from stuff that I've created on my own. And I remember gritting my teeth the whole way going, do I really have to do this
again?
And then you're like, and then you're again, and still, and then you're like, oh my God, but this is the best stuff. Cause it's so,
yeah. That's what a career is.
It's so unique. And that's how you make you,
you're a creator,
right? That's what we're about. We are not lumps of clay that Hollywood's going to go, I'm going to shape you into this and make you this. That's just not, we are not, you know, and you know.
I'm not a business guy. I don't know. Like, there's certain people who are creative and know the business. But I've realized, like, I hate the fucking business. I love creating.
Right.
And it's like, I was, you know, writing screenplays and just going through that cycle of, like, oh, maybe this is almost going to, oh, no. And then almost having a nervous breakdown. And I was like, you know what? I don't really want that. I just want to be creative and do things and have the time to. And it's like, I don't really give a fuck about success anymore. It seems, and anybody I've known, and we've all been around people who get famous, most people I know who've ended up famous are miserable. Yeah. It's never enough.
Or, you know, I will say, to your point, the ones who are happy, I think also a certain part of them doesn't give a fuck about success either, in a very healthy, beautiful way. Because when you give up that need to care about success, you actually are more successful in a way, because it's not so important to you, and it's not, you're holding on to the mundanity, the bullshit of it all. You're like, oh, I'm doing me, and that's, I know that sounds so cheesy, like, but that's successful. But like the people that I know who are, you know, whatever fill in the blank word you want to say of like they're winning, they're doing it, that are happy, are the ones that are like, meh, fuck it, let's play. Like they don't have this attachment. And the ones that are miserable, I think, have sort of still held on to this real, like, you know, and nothing's big enough for them. Nothing's good enough for them. And they're like, they're not famous enough or rich enough or you know, big enough.
And I bet you that's related to how much of a community they do or don't have.
Yeah,
because when you have the community and the family that knows you, not your fame, then you always feel good.
Yeah.
But when you, I know, and for me, it's like some of my friends that became super successful, like, because when it happens, it always seems like if it happens younger, it's always worse.
It is worse.
Because then you're 25 and you don't know the difference between someone who's giving you constructive criticism and a hater.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so when you hit it, you cut out all the people that you think doubt you, and then there's no one there to kind of check you and help you along. And then people who always seem to be famous and happy to me seem to always get it later.
Yeah.
I auditioned for SNL when I was 24, and I always think, it's like, if I would have gotten SNL, I would be...
You'd be a wreck.
I would be like, would be like a Corey Feldman type. Like, I would be a joke. Yeah. I know I would have, like, said something wrong on TV. Or I would have, like, crashed my car into a store.
Mm-hmm. Sure, same here. I had the exact same, you know, I was, I think, 28 when I auditioned, and I was way too young when I auditioned for that show. And I have the exact same thought of, like, if I had gotten that, it would have changed my life, of course, obviously, but... not in a great way, I don't think.
No.
So, yeah.
And then I spent a lot of time around those offices because I lived in New York and some of my friends wrote and worked on it. And I was like, once you're in that environment, I was like, I didn't want it. Like once
right,
I got, you
yeah.
get up close
don't
to it, it's
also,
ugly.
Also, I said, now I'm like, well, now I feel like I could do it. I could do the job. I'm way too old for it now. But it's like, that's
well, because
the,
you wouldn't take it too
it.
Seriously.
Right.
You wouldn't
job.
Be like,
it's
ah.
a gig.
Yeah.
You know, friends of mine that have done well on that show have been like, it's a job and I'm going to work and it's nightmarish hours. It's really hard. It's super competitive, but fuck it. It's a job. As opposed to, this is my life. This is everything I have,
yeah.
which is what your 20s are all about. So, anyway,
yeah.
well, we are out of time.
I hope we had some revelations.
None. I don't think we solved anything. So, sorry, you guys. No, this was awesome.
Thank you so much.
We got so deep.
Yeah.
We're deep.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we've ever gone to, I mean, this much into, just like our souls as artists, or
yeah,
a
good.
Reflection of our families and the world that's going on. I love it so much. So thank you guys so much for being on here. I want to thank my guests, Baron Vaughn and Matt Dwyer.
Thank you.
And this has been another episode of Minor Revelations.
Love you.
Love you.
Love you.